the underground bunker of the Civitas Studio in Raleigh, North Carolina, it's Civitalk with your hosts, Brooke Medina and Ray Nothstein. We're here to connect culture with civics, making it relevant to your daily life. And dare we say, existence at a time where too many are triggered and offended. So, relax, but buckle up, and let's wade into the deep end. What's really happening in your old North State?
Welcome to another edition of Civitalk. Today we have Daniel Gibson, associate attorney at the Stamm Law Firm, on the episode with us. Brooke, Daniel, how are you all doing today?
Doing good. Always glad to be here.
Today we are going to discuss the case that has made a lot of headlines, Bostick versus Clayton County, and that's why we have Daniel on today. And Daniel, just give us a rundown, just real briefly, before we get started on this case and why it's important.
So this case is actually three separate cases, but basically they all have the same fundamental thing going on in them, which is you have someone that's employed by a fairly small business, and that person either comes out as homosexual or comes out as transgendered, and then shortly after they say that, they get fired. So they sue their employer, and they say, you violated federal law. Specifically, you violated Title VII of the Civil Rights Act, which says you cannot discriminate because of sex. So the whole question in this case is, when you fire someone for being homosexual or being transgendered, do you fire them because of sex? And of course, the court's answer, for the majority at least, is yes. Because of sex includes discrimination on the basis of sexual orientation or gender identity.
So what's really interesting, I think, about this ruling on this particular case and in the concerns that many on the right hold about it, is that obviously there are religious liberty, possibly religious liberty implications, or so.
I would say definitely, Brooke. I think there's definitely religious liberty implications coming down.
Well, there's some rebuttals, and so I'd be curious to hear Dan's thoughts on, given Gorsuch's opinion, whether or not he created a pathway for religious institutions to sort of have an exemption from Title VII.
There are definitely a lot of unanswered questions in this case. And towards the end of his opinion, Justice Gorsuch sort of refers to some of those unanswered questions. He says, none of these other laws are before us. We haven't had the benefit of adversarial testing about the meanings of their terms, and we're not prejudging any of those questions today. And he's talking about laws on bathrooms or locker rooms or religious discrimination and religious exceptions. So I think undoubtedly there will be litigation over these issues. But I think if anyone holds up this opinion and says there is no religious liberty exception, this opinion says you can't have gender-specific bathrooms or gender-specific locker rooms, they obviously haven't read all of Gorsuch's opinion. Now, of course, this creates a new pathway, because this is something that the court had never previously read into Title VII. So when you're talking about other statutes that say because of sex or ban sex discrimination, maybe we can start making similar arguments about them. But I think Gorsuch takes great pains in his opinion to try to limit it to just Title VII and just this case. Now, we'll see how well that holds up, but I think there are some other cases that are before the court in this term that will definitely color how I view this case. One of which deals with the ministerial exception when you're talking about religious exceptions. So basically, if you have a school teacher who's not religious and is not teaching a religious subject, but you are a religious school, do you still qualify for religious liberty exceptions when you're making hiring and firing decisions? So if you're Catholic and you want to fire a history teacher who's gay and also not Catholic, do you have the right to do that? Do you qualify for a religious liberty exception? There are some other cases at the court that I think will clarify the answer to that question.
Yeah, but in the meantime, Daniel, does this open up lawsuits? Let's say lawsuits now, and I know they happen to some degree anyways, but does it give more credence to lawsuits? Let's say you're an employee of a Catholic church and they fire you. Maybe you're an employee at the school. They fire you for differences just in worldview on human sexuality. Now, does this give credence to someone who turns around and sues whether they're gay or whether they're transgender or whatever they're identifying as, and they turn around and sue the Catholic Church, the school, the parish, whatever, however that lawsuit plays out? Does this give credence right now to their lawsuit?
I think you're definitely going to see people testing the limits of this decision and trying to see what they can use this case for. So even though the case to me reads fairly narrowly, that doesn't mean that people aren't going to try to expand it. So in the example that you just gave, if the teacher was gay and was fired for being gay, I think they'd have a pretty good argument under this case. If they weren't gay or they were fired for encouraging homosexuality in students, even though it had nothing to do with their own sexuality, I think that would be a different question in this case, because the question here, again, is whether or not discrimination against someone because they're homosexual or transgendered is discrimination because of sex. And the way the court gets to its answer in this case is it says you can't know someone's status as homosexual or someone's status as transgendered without knowing that person's sex. So because of that, this is discrimination because of sex. But on the other hand, if you were to have the example of someone that's just encouraging homosexuality, you can encourage homosexuality without being homosexual. So you don't have to know someone's sex to say this person is encouraging homosexuality and we're going to fire them not because they are homosexual, but because they're encouraging it. So I think that maybe that decision would survive under this case.
Let's talk a little bit about the scope of the judiciary. And really, one of the many complaints that some of the dissenters, such as Alito, Thomas, and Kavanaugh, made in their dissents was that this is really, well, I think Alito was one that said this is legislation. This is not actually, this within the purview of the court. Do you think he's right?
I think that, Alito's opinion certainly took me by surprise. Alito is not, in my experience, normally quite so aggressive in how he writes. I mean, he says all sorts of very strong things about Gorsuch's opinion. At one point he says, this is like a textualist pirate ship. They're flying a textualist flag, but they're not being textualists. And that is a beautiful analogy, but it's not what I would expect from Alito. I think the question of the limits of the judiciary is sort of on the fringes of this case, because I really do think Gorsuch is trying to be a textualist here. I think a lot of this is a disagreement about what it means to be a textualist and at root what the concept of homosexuality and transgenderism actually is. So the opinion that I actually find the most convincing is Justice Kavanaugh's opinion for that reason. So basically what you got here is you have three different opinions. You have Gorsuch saying, I just care what the statute says. And the statute says because of sex, and a plain meaning of because of sex includes anything that relates to sex. He uses the term but for causation. So if sex is a factor in the decision, then you have discriminated against someone because of sex. Sex is a factor in homosexuality and transgenderism, so it's discrimination because of sex. Alito comes along and says, no one would have really thought that when this law was enacted. Congress didn't think it, and our courts haven't really held it, so we probably shouldn't do that. Kavanaugh, I think, makes a very good point, which is to say, okay, maybe that is the plain technical meaning of the statute. But one of these canons of construction, which is, how we sort of interpret words in statutes in the Constitution, is that we should interpret words in their ordinary meaning. So you either have to show us, number one, that we shouldn't interpret these words in their ordinary meaning, which we don't think you can do, or number two, that the ordinary meaning of because of sex in 1964 included discrimination because of sexual orientation or transgenderism. And they can't do that, so we should not include that within because of sex.
If because of sex or just the term sex can now take on a 21st century understanding. What's to say that race or age, which, I mean, people could argue, how are those any less fluid than sex in this case? Because really, essentially, Gorsuch and his decision was lumping gender identity with sexual orientation and sex, kind of putting them all in this umbrella under sex. And so I'm just wondering, do you think that, like, could someone feasibly argue against age discrimination if they decided to identify as a different age, let's say 15, 20 years down the road?
You know, I don't know Title VII super well. I don't know that Title VII prohibits age discrimination. What I would be interested in is, I know it includes race and national origin discrimination.
Let's hypothetically say Elizabeth Warren decided to identify as Native American.
Yeah, well, actually, that was something I thought about while I was reading this case, because I don't have any proof of this, but sort of my family's lore is that we're part Aboriginal, being Australian. And if I came to work and said, I'm Aboriginal, and now you're firing me because I identify as Aboriginal, would I have a Title VII claim? And I think maybe under this court's decision, you might, or under the Elizabeth Warren example, I think you might have an argument there, because race played a factor in that termination decision. And if you have this but-for causation test, then yeah, I think you have an argument. And actually, that's one of the arguments in Gorsuch's opinion that I probably have the most difficult time with. There's this race analogy that he draws, and he says, look, if you were going to fire someone for being in an interracial relationship, we would say that that is discrimination because of race. So if we change the hypothetical just a little bit and we change race for sex, and we're firing someone for being in a homosexual relationship, then that is sex discrimination for the same reason that the interracial relationship would be race discrimination. And that argument definitely has a certain logical appeal to it.
Well, I'm just really concerned because, I mean, I know you already brought this up, but to me, when I look at a textualist approach, I'm very concerned with this whole notion, just going back and getting to Alito's comments, is I don't understand how you can take the 1964 Civil Rights Act in. I think what you're doing is really damaging the separation of powers. And we see this with Title IX to some degree, where you have bureaucrats writing, you know, new language into the law and updating it from a cultural perspective. And so it just seems to me we're eroding the separation of powers here when we take something like this in the 1964 Civil Rights Act, which is a specific bill to address specific problems. And then, we're going to, because of this cultural situation we now face, we're going to reread that back into the text. To me, that's just, it's very problematic. So I just don't see, I'm just having a hard time, and obviously I'm not an attorney, but I'm having a hard time seeing the textualist argument from that perspective in terms of, to me, if you're talking about textualist, well, the defining meaning here is sex, and so I can take this to mean this and that. I just don't see it, because I don't think you're taking that from anything in our history or legal tradition. It's sort of like you're inventing it.
Yeah, I think that that's what's really interesting about this case, because I think you're seeing sort of at least two, possibly three different flavors of textualism here. Gorsuch is very much in the camp of, I just want to look at the words of the statute. I don't care what Congress said before it was passed. I don't care what Congress said after it was passed. I care what the statute says. And maybe I care what people thought the statute meant at the time, but I really care the most about what the actual words of the statute mean and how we apply them now.
That seems so flimsy, man.
With Alito and Kavanaugh, you have them sort of being more interested in the ordinary meaning that someone would read that those terms to have in 1964. And somewhat with Alito, and honestly, I'm probably the most uncomfortable with this part of Alito's decision. Alito seems to care a lot what Congress intended. And that's normally the sort of argument that you see more liberal judicial interpreters making, which is to say we care the purpose of this statute more than the actual words of this statute. So, you know, I think it's interesting that Gorsuch came out this way, and I was certainly surprised when I read this opinion, but this is not out of the ordinary for Gorsuch. And one of, I think, the biggest takeaways that we should have from this case is Gorsuch might do this again. And Gorsuch is really a very particular type of textualist. I think he's very interested in what the statute itself says. You need to convince him that the plain language of the statute supports your position. And again, he doesn't care what Congress said that it meant. He cares what Congress said in its statute. I mean, he says a few times in here, only the written word is law. When I originally read this opinion, I thought, well, maybe Gorsuch and Roberts flipped to limit this holding. But then I went back and re-listened to the oral arguments. And there's actually a point in the arguments where Gorsuch, and I thought he was just saying this hypothetically, he says, I'm with you on the textual evidence when he's talking to the ACLU's lawyer. He says, let's not talk about extra textual stuff. We're talking about the text. It's close. And it seems like he's looking for someone to give him an out, because he goes on and says, you know, the text is close. So at the end of the day, shouldn't we consider, and he uses the words, the massive societal upheaval that our decision would entail. And I guess between oral argument and today, he decided that the massive societal upheaval just doesn't really matter as much as the actual text of the statute. So in a way, I have sort of a begrudging admiration for him for sticking to his guns when it comes to the text. I mean, one of my core ideas as a textualist is that sometimes the text of the law isn't going to give me the result that I want it to give me, and I'm going to follow the text of the law regardless. Now, I obviously don't agree with Gorsuch in this case, because I think that we should consider the ordinary public meaning at the time that the statute was enacted. And I don't think the ordinary public meaning included any of this. You're going to have a pretty hard time convincing me that it included transgenderism when I don't think transgenderism existed as a concept in 1964. Maybe you could make a case for homosexuality, but I don't think anyone in 1964 thought this included homosexuality. No, because if no they way. Did, I think it would have lost miserably.
Yeah, there's no way about that. To me, it just seems like a culture. It seems like they're just using the courts to fix a cultural sort of phenomenon that's going on. And to me, that just leads to, that's just a deadly path. Maybe not literally deadly for
it could be,
but you know what I mean. I mean, and that was, I think, the problem with the marriage ruling, whether you agreed with it or not. It there was no legislative process to any of this. I mean, you still had the Defense of Marriage Act, which was signed by Bill Clinton and part of federal law, and you just struck it down because, well, we have got this cultural phenomenon, and we're going to extend civil rights in such a way that we're not going to deal with any of this on the legislative side. And it's just, to anybody that would say that this is positive, that there's positives for religious liberty coming out of this, I think is living in their own little universe, or that this is going to be a good outcome for anybody under the religious liberty banner. So that's kind of how I read it. And that's with my limited understanding. And I haven't done as much reading, and I obviously don't have as much legal education as you do or practice, but certainly just on their side of the reading, that's how I read. And I didn't read all of the dissents or the decision, but you know, from what I have read, I mean, to me, it's just so clear that it's just trying to solve a cultural problem. And you can say that textualism led you there, but I think there's still a reality that you're still trying to solve this cultural tension through the courts, which ultimately is going to be a huge detriment to this nation. 2015 was a big turning point, Daniel. I mean, I think where we're headed.
I think that might be why Roberts, and I'm hypothesizing here, I think that might be why Roberts changed sides. And maybe, you know, I originally said it's why Gorsuch changed sides so that they could limit this holding. Yeah, you know, I had originally thought Roberts joins the liberals first, then Gorsuch jumps along so he can write a really narrow opinion. I think maybe it might have happened the other way around, where Gorsuch had already joined the liberals, and then Roberts came along, because the way opinion writing works at the court is the senior most justice, unless you're the chief justice, gets to decide who writes the opinion. So before Roberts would have joined that block, it would have been Ginsburg. And I think Ginsburg would have given this opinion to Kagan. And from what I know of Kagan, we would have had a very different opinion if Kagan had written it. So Roberts comes along and hands the decision to Gorsuch, and you get, you know, the way I described this case to one of my friends was, this is like conservatives arguing over the corpse of Antonin Scalia. Gorsuch is saying, I'm the real heir of Antonin Scalia, and Alito and Kavanaugh are saying, no, you're not. You're a textualist pirate. So in some ways, I'm glad if the court had to issue this decision, I'm glad it was Gorsuch that was the one writing the opinion. Because I think, number one, he's just a darn good writer. But number two, this is a fairly narrow opinion, which certainly has implications of other cases that it could affect, but it's trying its best not to affect those things.
So something, another angle of this that outside of the religious liberty angle that concerns me, though, is how it impacts biological women, whether that's in sports or I was talking to my husband about this ruling the other day, and just my heart went out to women who have suffered from domestic violence, for example, and they are in a battered women's shelter. And so they just have genuine fear of those of the opposite sex, whether they present themselves that way or not. And I'm really curious about some of the implications of this that we're not, that we just have no clue of quite yet. But those are, and again, locker rooms as well. That's another one that just came to mind. And so I think that this is this goes to show how weighty Supreme Court nominations are. And that was a reason that many conservatives said they were going to vote for President Trump in 2016 was that, you know, they trusted his decisions for Supreme Court picks more than a Hillary Clinton's. And you made the good point, though, that you have to look at a judge's philosophy rather than just, you know, thinking they're going to rule one way or another because of their political positions. And so that was clearly the case with Gorsuch. But I think this really really makes it harder for President Trump going into 2020. So I'm kind of pivoting political over here. But I think that that's my example of the women and how the implications of biological women from this case, the religious liberty implications. Like, these are things that conservatives are going to go into the voting booth thinking about, I would imagine, in November. And so I'm just curious to get y'all's thoughts on how this impacts the race.
Yeah, I actually did a super unscientific poll last week before this decision was handed down, and I felt kind of good about myself, you know, seeing this week's opinions. I called up a few of my friends who are what I would consider Trump skeptical voters, people who don't want to vote either way because they don't like either candidate, but may have voted for Trump in the last election. And I said, hey, if the court says that the law protects homosexuals from being fired or transgender people from being fired, or the court doesn't really do anything major with Roe v. Wade, how is that going to affect how you vote in November? And the hypothetical I specifically had in mind was Chief Justice Roberts. I did not see Gorsuch doing any of this stuff. And in my very unscientific poll, about 2/3 of them said that they would be more likely to vote for Trump under those circumstances. But again, that was specifically the hypothetical was Chief Justice Roberts. And what I'm worried about the most at this point is June Medical, which is the abortion case that's still pending at the court. I think whatever happens in that case may eclipse this Bostick v. Clayton County case. If the court decides to overrule directly or indirectly Roe v. Wade, everyone's going to forget about this. And I think if the court doesn't, especially if Roberts joins the liberals, then people are going to forget about that too. I think it would be terrible for Trump if one of his appointees prevented the court from doing anything about Roe v. Wade in the June medical case. I think this case hurts Donald Trump somewhat, but I think if Roberts continues doing the sorts of things that he's been doing this week, I could see Trump taking direct aim at Roberts and Trump's supporters really backing him on it. Roberts is a Bush appointee, and Bush hasn't exactly been very kind to Donald Trump. And, you know, it becomes Trump versus Bush again, you know, drain the swamp versus establishment Republicans all over again. And here's another reason to reelect Donald Trump so we can put more real conservatives on the court instead of establishment conservatives, I think is how Trump's campaign would play it under those circumstances.
Yeah, I think you're exactly right, Daniel. I agree with you on that. And we forget, too, I mean, George W. Bush wanted to nominate Harriet Myers, who was very unproven, had no, virtually, at least to my knowledge, no judicial record, so to speak, of any sorts. So, I mean, and of course, you had Bush's father who nominated Souter, who was, for conservatives, at least a disaster on the court. Thankfully, he decided he wanted to retire and hang out at his vacation home. So I completely agree. I mean, I just come to back to this is kind of a cultural phenomenon in terms of the way the court's ruling. This is not something you would have seen conservatives jump to 10 years ago. No way. You know, the 2015 ruling, I think, just had huge ramifications in where we're headed in terms of the cultural landscape kind of influencing the judiciary. And I guess one can argue if that's a good thing or a bad thing. But I think that's the truth of the matter. And I think religious liberty will continue to be in peril because I think there's a side where, you know, we hope that we can have kind of civil disagreement in this nation. But there's a side that's not going to accept any kind of dissent on the issue of homosexuality, on transgenderism. They're just not going to accept dissent on that. They're not going to accept even people in their private spheres and their private, you know, whether it's a church life or school life, private schools I'm talking here, to say, we don't believe in this, we don't adhere to that. I think because there's a struggle against human nature and natural law with some folks. And if you don't, you know, if you don't have any recognition of that, then I think you have to destroy any sort of voice that kind of that amplifies any of those arguments in society. So, I mean, I don't think we're on a good path here. But I think that Trump, I don't think this actually hurts Trump because look, I mean, Gorsuch is still far better than anybody that the left is going to nominate. And I think that he is genuinely, I think, you know, is genuinely going to be on our side the vast majority of the time, at least on the conservative side of things. So I think in some ways this actually may help Trump because I think it'll just further, I think these conservatives out there, I see them on Twitter or libertarians or whatever saying, well, see, you shouldn't support Trump because look at these nominees. Well, I mean, I think the Supreme Court issue may be a little bit more of a long game than one appointment. We're finding that out, and I think we knew that for a long time. So, you know, I know the Federalist Society is more involved in the picks now. They pretty much rubber stamped them for this president, and I'd say that's a good thing. So this is a long game. This is not, you know, something that's decided in one or two decisions, so to speak.
Yeah, I think there's a few things at play there. One is the liberal justices tend to be much more ideologically consistent than the conservative justices. And I'm not talking about just this court. I'm talking about probably since 1950. I mean, we can point out whether it's Sandra Day O'Connor or Kennedy or Souter or Gorsuch today, conservatives sort of swinging in a different direction. I can't think of a liberal justice who's gone the other way. Now, maybe that's just my bias showing. But I think some of that is just inherent in conservatism, which is to say that part of what we're trying to do as a movement is to say, hey, maybe all of these societal changes aren't actually good things. Maybe we should take this a little bit slower. Maybe we should be a little bit more thoughtful about how we do it. And if that's your position, some of those changes are going to take place anyways. You know, sometimes you're going to find yourself out of step with public policy. But I think the thing that I'm the most concerned about in all of this, and this is a concern that I've had about Trump for a long time, I think Donald Trump says and actually does a lot of things that I like about societal issues, whether that's abortion or appointing judges or protecting religious liberty. But I don't think Donald Trump's heart is really in it. And that was my biggest concern with his judicial nominees. Gorsuch and Kavanaugh are definitely qualified. But are they really there on the socially conservative front? And I think a lot of this decision that Gorsuch has handed down really is about what you think about homosexuality and what you think about transgenderism. It's a philosophical question. And as much as I'm happy with Gorsuch and Kavanaugh to have been appointed to the court, I worry that when Trump is examining justices, he's not examining them in the same way that someone who shares the same convictions that I share would actually examine them. Which is not to say that he's going to appoint terrible justices. It's just to say that I think Donald Trump cares a lot more about business and economics than he does about religion.
I think that's a fair point. I mean, certainly, you know, Kavanaugh is somebody who's grew up in the Beltway. I mean, his whole career, he's from the Washington, D.C. area. His parents were, I think, politically connected. I mean, it was nice to see Gorsuch, somebody at least from middle America, even though all these justices, I believe, you can correct me if I'm wrong, but they all have Ivy League pedigrees and all from just a couple of schools, essentially, two or three, four, whatever it is. So, you know, it'd be nice to see a little more, I think, diversity from the justices. I'm going to say something kind of controversial here, though. I mean, I think, you know, I don't think we're headed in a good direction. I think 2015, if a country doesn't understand sort of basic, and I'm all for a culture of equality and for respect and all this stuff, but I feel like if a country doesn't understand the differences between a biological male and female, I think that's troubling. And I think that will head you, that will send you on a troubling path ultimately and sort of just a kind of a culture of disorder. And I say that with all due grace and respect and love for people. But I do feel like if a country can't even say kind of some basic scientific truths about the differences between male and female, then I feel like we're set up for a lot of perilous problems going forward. And that's probably controversial to some nowadays, but I feel like it's the truth.
Yeah, that's an important point to make, is that we should be able to still say, even outside of the metaphysical components to sexuality, but being able to just talk about chromosomes there and even still, like, while acknowledging, I mean, there are chromosomal disorders like Klinefelter where that would give a male an extra chromosome. But nonetheless, I mean, like, these are just very, very basic science aspects. And but like you said, they can still be seasoned with grace, wherein we're able to discuss these things and still very much care about those people who disagree with us on such issues. And I think until we're able to really have some of these honest discussions without getting so offended that we feel the need to shut and shout down the other side, we can't really move forward. But real quick, we're running out of time. Daniel, I wanted to point out, you were talking about you didn't recall a case where liberals justices maybe had swung the other way. And so, I mean, I'm thinking of Masterpiece Cake's decision, where there were seven justices that sided with the defendant on that. And so that was Breyer, Kagan, and Kennedy all came to the other side.
I don't know if I'd count Kennedy on the other side on that. He's been at least, you know, when he was on.
Well, he's a flip flopper.
Yeah, but he was pretty consistent on religious liberty issues.
Yeah, to be clear, what I mean is, like, not necessarily a one-off case where you get a weird alignment. I mean someone who's appointed by a Democrat with the idea that this person is going to be liberal and stay liberal, then becoming conservative.
I see. I gotcha.
So, yeah, okay. There's definitely one-off cases, but you don't have the Souters and the O'Connors and the Kennedys, at least to my knowledge, of the left.
Yeah, that's a good point. Well, we are out of time for this week. So I so appreciate your insights on this, Dan, and just giving us a better understanding of the legal side of this, but also our discussion altogether about some of the other implications of this culturally and politically. So we hope you all have a wonderful week, and thank you for listening. Always feel free to leave a review for us on iTunes, and you can also subscribe to us on Spotify or Google Play. You all have a wonderful week.
Thank you.
Thanks again for having me.